like to go from a place where the kids could hardly have recess and there weren't a lot of things we could do about it.
We're talking school climate with one of the people that inspires Dr. John Hattie. Are you serious?
And now it's time for another edulicious episode of the Bentley Brothers Podcast, bringing you what's current and what works in education. Here are your hosts, Scott and Tim Bentley.
Bentley Brothers, Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bentley Brothers, yep. Bentley, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Yep. First name Bentley, last name Brothers, bringing education information like no others.
Yes, we're serious. That's right, Scott. Today we have Peter DeWitt on the show. Before I introduce him,
Dr. Peter DeWitt, Tim.
Dr. Peter DeWitt. Before I introduce the fine doctor, we are going to talk about a couple of things that we're passionate about. First of all, EduPresenters. If you haven't signed up yet and you are an educational presenter, you want to make sure you get over to edupresenters.com. And is it .com or .org?
.com, Tim. It's a one-of-a-kind marketplace where districts can post any jobs they need for presenters or trainers, and trainers can connect with those and bid at those jobs. So check it out. It's brand new. It is going to be the way to find presenters for districts and for presenters to connect and share with their expertise, really, Tim, is what it's all about, getting them a chance to share directly with the districts that are looking.
Kind of like an online dating site.
Kind of, right? It's like Match.com, but for like districts and presenters. Like, there's a need, right?
There is. And then the other thing we want to make sure our listeners remember is that we've got coming up real shortly is this the fourth annual or fifth? I've lost track. I think
it's the fourth. Yeah.
Fourth annual Global School Play Day, where kids around the world on February the 7th are going to be celebrating unstructured play along with their teachers and their classmates and their principal and their parents and the campus supervisors and the janitors and whoever else is going to get involved in just putting aside their regular work for the day and just celebrating unstructured play. Kids need that so badly, don't they, Scott?
Yeah, and it's not us as teachers or administrators or whoever on campus as adults deciding what the kids do. It's just us watching, monitoring, getting insight as to the kids. It's one of the best things that I've loved about Global School Play Day, Tim, the last 3 years, is just watching how my kids interact with their peers. That's always a question parents have, is like, how do my kids interact with their friends and peers? And it's really hard to know in a structured environment. So to give them this day back really gives us as teachers an opportunity to observe really what those kids are like without the structure, which is powerful.
Yeah, and not only do we find out how they're doing at it, but the kids actually learn to become social and engage with each other when they play, which is such a neglected thing in our culture today. Kids just aren't getting out and playing anymore. They're staring at devices, or they're, you know, overbooked with all these activities. None of them are bad. Devices aren't bad. I mean, we're on a device right now, but you know, the kids just aren't getting out and being balanced and playing. So that's what this day is all about, is raise awareness. And we want you to go to globalschoolplayday.com, sign up your class, your school, your district, the whole state, whoever you're in charge of, that's going to play on February the 7th. So globalschoolplayday.com. Check it out, learn more about the event, and sign up. So anyway, back to our guest here that we've been excited to talk to. Peter DeWitt was a teacher for 11 years, a principal for 8 years, and now he's a consultant, he's an author, and he works with John Hattie, the great John Hattie, and he is a leader. He's an education, he trains in educational leadership. He hails out of Albany, New York, where he is seated right now, and we're so glad to have you on the show, Peter.
Thank you for having me. I'm seated here because I can't move because it's so cold.
Peter, we're excited to have you on our Authors Month. This is our fifth annual Authors Month shows, and we've dubbed January Authors Month here on the Bentley Brothers. But let's start it off, because it is Authors Month, and just talk about some of the books that you've written and what was your purpose behind those for impacting education.
You know, the first book that I wrote was called Dignity for All, Safeguarding LGBT Students, and it was actually the basis of my doctoral work. So that came out in about 2012 with Corwin, so I would say that pretty much set everything else off. I've written, you know, short-form books like Flipping Leadership Doesn't Mean Reinventing the Wheel. That's for the Connected Educator series that I created for Corwin. But lately it's, you know, Collaborative Leadership, Six Influences That Matter Most came out in September of 2016. So John Hattie's work was the basis for that. And then School Climate just came out last September. So it's leading with collective efficacy. That's also with Corwin. And I have a book coming out in probably about August or September of this year on coaching leaders. So, yeah.
Can you give us a little nugget from the School Climate book that you wrote? Our dad also wrote a book on school climate. And
Oh, really?
Way back in the day.
It's just, it's one of those topics that I think I've always been very interested in. You know, when I started teaching, I was teaching in Poughkeepsie, New York, which is about an hour outside of New York City. You know, I'm a kid from a it's from upstate New York, very white population within Queensbury at the time. And I started teaching Poughkeepsie, which was just this incredibly diverse place. And I think just looking around my classroom and trying to make sure books were representative of the students that were in my classroom. And then, you know, this was in the mid 90s. And one of the journals that kind of saved my life at that time, maybe I'm a little bit dramatic when I'm saying it, but it was called Rethinking Schools. And it came out you know, a few times a year. And I just remember reading that journal all the time. And it was like they were speaking directly to me because it was helping make a connection with kids that I didn't always know if I could make a connection with. And I think just back then, being conscious of it within my classroom and the climate I set up there became a passion. And it was something that I looked at very much when I was a school principal too. We went through a lot of issues in our school district, and not because of the school district, but mostly because of state mandates and accountability measures that were happening in New York State. And I just found that this outside noise was sort of, it was sort of hurting our morale within our school. And I didn't have assistant principals. It was just me and it was the teachers and the school community. So it was, I think I've always tried to look at, okay, I can't control this, but let's work together to sort of control this and make it a better place for kids. So, you know, you were talking about Global Play Day. I was very lucky because when I was a teacher in some high poverty city schools, and we didn't always get the opportunity to go out and play and have recess. At one of the schools, the playground was so small, we were only allowed to go out about 3 days a week. And these were kids that didn't feel safe going out in their own neighborhood. So that was the only time they were going outside. And then I became a principal where we had 27 acres of land. And Oh yeah, it was crazy. It was great. It was sort of in the hills, and we had a pond, and the kids snowshoed at recess. And like I flipped lunch. So lunch was 25 minutes and recess was 35 minutes. And like to go from a place where the kids could hardly have recess and there weren't a lot of things we could do about it to go into a place where it was just the center of what we did was a very cool experience for me. So all of that, all of those things that I'm talking about, the dignity for all thing where, you know, for my doctoral dissertation, to being a principal, to kind of having that classroom when I was a teacher, all of that, I just always felt like I needed to make a better climate for kids within, whether it was my classroom or whether it was within the school.
Hey, Peter, how does a teacher measure climate or an administrator? I mean, I know you deal more with administrators. How does that climate get measured? Is it a Google form that goes out? Is it just one-to-one conversations, a little bit of all of that?
I think it's, you know, that's such a hard question because I think it's all of it, right? You know, from sort of that macro level, you can look at the National School Climate Center. There's somebody I've worked with for a long time, and they have survey tools. They have measurements that they can do from that level. But, you know, I think it's also what you said. It's the conversations that we have. I always felt like what blew me away as a principal, because I went directly from teaching second grade in a city school to becoming a principal in another school district. And what blew me away is that people would remember these conversations that I had with them a year before. And it's not that I was having some profound conversation. It was just that I was the principal. They kind of remembered those things. And it made me realize that all of the words we use really matter. So, you know, it's from that end, but it's also from the actions that you put up. For me, there are some non-negotiables. It's when I walk into a school, what images do I see in the hallway? What books do I see? What curriculum do I see getting covered? But for a principal to be able to measure that kind of stuff, they need to look at everything they have done up until this point, meaning the conversations they've had, the teacher voice that's been allowed within the school. You know, when we were going through the accountability measures, one of the ways that I guess I measured school climate was that a lot of the teachers, we had principals advisory council, a lot of the teachers were talking about that, you know, morale was low. And we just sort of started to do these activities to get to the heart of the issue. After those kind of moments, when you send out a survey to staff, they're going to be more likely to fill out the survey and you're going to get that measurement there as well. But there's so much prep work that needs to be done before you can just hand out a survey and say, hey, let me know what school climate is like. So I hope that makes sense when I say it that way.
It totally does. And I've been doing the Google form send home to parents. And honestly, it's been scary because I'm putting something out there that's probably I've never done. And I've been teaching 24 years and I've done it for the last few years. And each time I click that button to share and email out the link, I'm like, oh my gosh, what if they say I'm horrible? And I'm like, oh no, this is going to crush me. I don't think I can take this. And I feel like there's a lot of teachers that are in that same boat. And I know that administrators feel that same way too, because you want to make this impact so deeply on the climate of a school. So what are some things that, you know, barring any kind of surveys or things like that, that can be the first steps towards changing climate? Because I know it takes like 5 years at least to change a climate or impact climate.
I think you work on the climate first and then you start to chip away at the culture, right? Climate is how you feel when you walk in, but culture is what happens when you've been there for a while. And, you know, much to what you were saying, sending out that survey is scary, but just taking that step is really important. And it makes me, sometimes when we send those things out, it makes me think of Douglas Stone and Sheila Heen wrote a great book called Thanks for the Feedback. And we send something out like that because we're looking for appreciation feedback, where we're waiting for parents to say how much the kids love our classroom. And when we get that feedback that shows us that they don't love it so much, it hurts when we're looking at that. I was working in Iowa. The collaborative leadership work has been adopted in Iowa at the state level. And there was a principal that I was working with that said she sent out a survey to her staff. And she was really nervous, and it took her about 2 weeks to actually read the results. And when she read them, she said she cried because some of the people were just really mean. And I said, what did you do next? And she said, I actually shared it at the faculty meeting, which I think is brilliant. So, you know, I think what you were saying is really a great way to kind of look at that too, to hand out a survey, but nothing so lengthy. Make it shorter. I send out a pre-engagement survey before I go to present anywhere. If I'm going to run a workshop or something like that, I send out a pre-engagement survey because me, or they hear a name or they read a bio, but I want to know them when I'm walking in. And one of the questions on the pre-engagement survey is, what do you wish the presenter knew about you? And I'll tell you, I am blown away by what some people write in those. And I take it to heart because I want to know those things. I want to understand that context before I come in. And it's funny, because 9 times out of 10, people will write, I want the presenter to know how hard we work. And that's just kind of like, that's amazing to me that I'm working with adults and what they want me to know the most is how hard they work. So, you know, for that standpoint, I think what kind of messages, when you're looking at school climate, what kind of messages are you also sending out to your staff and the school community? I mean, that's why it's like peeling an onion for me, because even when I was working with families, when I was teaching, they didn't like me very much. And it was before they even knew me, because I represented something that they didn't know. Meaning that I was this guy who had a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, but I represented a place that may not have treated them very well when they were students. So like, I always think about that kind of stuff. You know, what kind of language do we use? I'm sure we'll talk a lot about John Hattie, but John is really great about talking about that too, is when we're working with our families, when we're working with families who are living in poverty, what kind of language are we using when they're coming in to see us? Because if we're using all these, if we're dropping acronyms left and right, we are losing parents every time we do that.
And some teachers too, Peter.
Yeah. No, seriously though, like wherever I go now, and when I'm in different states or even different countries, people drop acronyms all the time, and I'm a guy with a doctorate and I don't want to ask them what it means. So imagine what it's like with a family member who's coming in to go through that same experience. So I realize that's kind of like this, well, this roundabout answer to what you're saying, but like all of that stuff matters.
Yeah. You know, how much does just the personality, the aura that the leader gives off matter? I mean, because to me, as I think back over my career and who I've been led by, like that just seems to make such a huge deal. I mean, if the person's coming in and they're just positive and upbeat, you know, it's like they don't really need a lot of techniques and tricks. It's just that they themselves develop a climate just by being themselves, you know?
Yeah, it's welcoming people in. It's pulling kids off the bus. It's, you know, saying good morning to them. It's the simple stuff that I'm sure your dad talked about when he was talking about school climate, which is meeting kids at the doorway and getting to know their names. My friend Russ Qualia does a lot of work in student voice. And there's a strong percentage of kids that have been surveyed that say, my teacher doesn't know my name or my principal doesn't know my name. And it's like, wow, we have to do that first. And yeah, when I, you know, I often, when I'm presenting, we'll talk about some of the leaders that I worked for. And there was one person in particular, it was their first year as a principal, my last year as a teacher. And we were very excited about this person taking over as principal because they had been the science coordinator for the school district. And within a month, we were no longer excited that they had taken over as principal because they started checking lesson plans like every 3 or 4 weeks. And I didn't have a problem with that because I handed my lesson plans in. I always had them done. It didn't mean I did anything in them, but I always had them done. And one time I forgot to hand them in. And I swear to you, like, the next morning I ran up to her and just said, I am so sorry, I forgot to hand these in last night. And she quickly handed them back to me and said, oh, don't even worry about it. I don't check yours anyway. And I thought, why am I handing them in then? And so like that stuff, you're right, is that when it's that behavior that we have as school leaders, that if we're looking to control everything, if we're in the front main office, which is great every single day, but all we're doing is looking at teachers saying, I need to talk to you first, that's not going to be very helpful. But if we're smiling, and like my goal was to always get people laughing when they walked into the main office, when they started off the day, because the next place they went was the classroom to be with kids. And so you're right. It's like all of that is really important.
I love that. Get people laughing. So important.
Yeah, I wasn't always funny, but you know, sometimes the jokes were just so corny, they just felt like they had to laugh anyway. But I think I learned as a principal that because I worked for somebody who they could walk down the hallway and we would be the only two in the hallway. And one day they would say, hello, Peter, how are you doing? And the next day they would completely ignore me walking down the hallway and I was the only one there. And I remember walking into the classroom going, do not show your face for the rest of the day because it's just going to be a bad day. And I felt like, if I felt like that as a teacher, I certainly didn't want to be able to do that when I was a school principal. So when I was a school principal, it was about making sure people are smiling and laughing. And clearly some days are harder than others, but it's really important that we do that because, you know, you got to think, we're at a school. How bad can it be?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Military.
I'm so with you on
this. I was an elementary school teacher. It's like, I'm working with kids and
this should be fun.
Yes. They come from some pretty horrible situations. And it's like the last thing they need is a downer for a principal when they're walking in like, oh, here we go, kids. It's like, no, that's not what we're supposed to be doing. If that's what you're doing, get out.
Now, there's enough joy killers like standardized testing in education and I'm not against testing at all. Testing's important. It gives us feedback as teachers on how we can adjust. Well, standardized testing, like, oh my gosh. So I'm so thankful for this conversation you're having. And I just would say to any teachers that are listening out there, just have fun. Let stuff go. It doesn't have to be, it's not going to be perfect. My room's never perfect. Tim's is perfect every day. I don't know about that, but.
Well, I can see that right now. I mean, that's pretty obvious. You know, it's funny, Scott, because when I was a principal and we were dealing with a lot of accountability and mandates, and we also in our district dealt with millions of dollars of budget cuts and staff layoffs. And here we're closing a one classroom per grade level school, and I'm absorbing the whole population. Like it was just a mess all the way around. But for me, the fortunate part is I started writing the blog for EdWeek, and I became very outspoken in New York State against state testing because it was just pummeling us all the time, and we were not getting the feedback that we should have been getting. We were not getting an item analysis. And that was the only thing the media was reporting on. And I'm in the capital of New York State, so of course we're going to report on it all the time. It was just negative rhetoric all the time. And I could have either cowered down and said, we just have to go with it. Or I could stand up and say, I need to tell the story of what's going on in our school. And from the blog perspective, I mean, I became very outspoken. I was one of 8 principals in New York State to write a letter against having state testing tied to teacher evaluation. In the blog, I had written about, never rude, I was never rude about what I was doing, but I was writing about the harmful impact it was having on school. And it, you know, got to the point where even the commissioner's office called my office to change my blog because they didn't like what I was writing about. And, you know, that's where I met people like Christina Luce, who we were talking about before we went on air, because what I didn't realize is that there were a lot of teachers out there that didn't have a supportive principal, and I was one of these principals who was actually speaking out. And that did not always make me popular. It didn't always make me popular in my own district where I would be getting some pressure. And it also didn't make me very popular with the state education office because they were – but what I needed to do was look and say – we can control, we need to talk about this. We need to talk about the harmful impact state testing is having on what we do as teachers and what we do in a classroom. But on the flip side, what I need to be able to do, and this is where I started doing things like flip faculty meetings, is look at staff and say, we can't control this noise. I can speak out about it on this side. But when we're together, we have to do what we can. And that's collective efficacy. We have to do what we can to combat this. So I did things like no testing week. And what that meant was there was a week in December where I just said, we are not going to do any testing whatsoever. We're going to do project-based learning, all this kind of stuff. I mean, I had a fourth grade teacher that built a longhouse in the middle of the hallway that kids had to walk through every day. And I had parents that came, like we had a huge community turnout for this on a Thursday night. We were like, come and see what we've been doing all week. And I remember at the end of that week, some of the teachers said, I wish we could do that every week. And I said, listen, we can't do that every week, but we can find a better balance because even with the constraints we were under, we just did that. So let's figure out a happy medium between the two. And I just think that's the kind of stuff that too often I see school leaders, and I'm not always easy on school leaders, but I see too many school leaders, and this is what bothered me when I was a principal. So many people would complain behind closed doors about all of the things that were happening. But when they would get out in front of the open, they wouldn't say a word about it. And they would just, let's make it happen kind of thing. And I felt like all I was ever talking about in the blog was stuff that everybody else was saying behind closed doors. I just happened to say it out in the open. And sometimes that didn't make me very popular.
No, Peter, like the kids need teachers to advocate. That's one of the reasons Tim and Eric and the group of us started Global School Play Day. We felt like we need to advocate for kids. As teachers, we need administrators advocating for what's right for schools and teachers and kids. And we appreciate administrators that step up and do that. And there's a lot of great ones out there that are doing that. But things will change if there's a lot more doing that, that's for sure.
Yeah, you know, and I do. I have a real luxury to work with a lot of really great leaders, but I've worked with those leaders that just, they don't even maintain the status quo. They're like, okay, here's the next initiative that we need to make work. And it's like, but it's not good.
Like, what does it matter? At least we're doing something.
I know. Come on.
All right, Peter. Well, we are going to switch gears with you right now. I think we're going to have you back on the show and talk to you about the John Hattie stuff. And your body of work is just so huge that it's like no way we can cram even a little slice of it into 20 minutes and talking to you. But we're going to switch gears and have a little fun right now. Speaking of playing.
And, pressure's on.
Yeah. So we know that you have spent a good portion of your life in the state capital of New York, Albany. So we're going to play a little game with you today that we're calling Weird Al Beneath. So we're going to ask you some questions about some Stranger Things from about Albany, New York. So, Scott, why don't you tell our audience who Peter will be competing for today?
Tim, I really loved that name of this game. Nice work, dude.
I thought of it like 10 seconds ago.
Well, I give you prob. Hey, there's nothing like the last second. Peter, you'll be competing for Lisa Mead.
Yes.
And she's an administrator, am I correct?
She is. She's an assistant superintendent in Hudson Falls, New York, which is about an hour away from me. And Lisa is one of my greatest stalkers. I mean, one of my greatest friends. So I'm a little nervous because what people don't know is that Scott literally said before we went on air that no one has ever gotten too wrong. So now the pressure's on.
Well, we have some pretty smart guests on here, just like you, Dr. DeWitt. Now, if you're able to answer two out of the three correctly, then Lisa, she's going to be awarded a free download that she can give out to any one of her second through sixth grade teachers in her district by this ridiculously popular edger rock band, Rockin' Standards.
All right. Thanks, awesome. Scotty. So here we go, Peter, with your first question. There's a very good chance that one of the following American legends was first heard about in Albany, New York.
What?
Originated from Albany, New York. Is it A?
Santa Claus.
Or is it B?
Bigfoot.
Or is it C?
Blackbeard the Pirate.
So one of those actually originates from Albany, New York.
Yes. So, well, hopefully if I'm wrong, I'm going to get you on a technicality, but Santa Claus.
And that's correct.
Woo!
It is Santa Claus. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, it's it was the Night Before Christmas. It was actually written in Troy, New York, from a guy for his daughter back a very long time ago.
Yeah, very cool.
And Troy, New York is close to Albany, is that correct?
We are the Tri-City, so it is right next door. So even if I was wrong, I caught you on the technicality.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so good job. Number two, which two famous Americans were shockingly in Albany at the same time? Is it A?
Mark David Chapman and John Lennon.
Is it B?
Lee Harvey Oswald and John F. Kennedy.
Or is it C?
Abraham Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth.
So kind of eerie that these two people were together.
People get this right, huh?
Yeah, you'll get this one right. Don't worry. So either was it John Lennon with his assassin, Mark David Chapman? Was it John F. Kennedy with his, Lee Harvey Oswald? Yeah. Or was it Abraham Lincoln with his, John Wilkes Booth?
I'm going to go with A.
Mark David Chapman and John Lennon? Well, I guess I was wrong, too. You got that one wrong.
That was a tough.
Yeah, that would make sense because John Lennon spent a lot of time in New York, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it was actually Abraham Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
We're together.
Some social studies teacher out there from Queensbury High School is going to be very embarrassed for me right now.
Yeah, well, I guess they didn't do their job quite well enough with you, did they? Because that's such an important thing to know about American history. All right, number three. One well-known American president was once governor of New York. He would exercise by running up and down the 77 front steps of the Capitol building every morning. Who was this U.S. president? Was it A?
Teddy Roosevelt.
Or was it B?
Grover Cleveland.
Or was it C?
Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, I don't think it would have been Franklin Roosevelt. So I'm going to go with Teddy.
Whoa!
Yeah,
you got it right.
Woo! Oh God, I'm thought Teddy, I was going to Google really quick.
Yeah, well, I'm not real familiar with Teddy Roosevelt, but I kind of pictured him as being a little bit rotund, and you know, just the idea of him running the steps.
Hey, Tim. Oh man,
Oh, that's true. Yeah, yeah. He was like a hunter and all that.
Hunter. He was a good American.
Tough dude, right?
Yeah,
just because you're a little rotund too doesn't mean run.
You can't run 77 steps all the time.
What are you trying to say, bro? I've got my resolution. Come on, leave me alone.
I will say I feel better knowing that one than I would have, you know, for question number two. So I'm feeling like I redeemed myself.
Oh, you definitely did. Scott, how did Dr. DeWitt do today?
Good job, Peter. You got 2 out of 3 correct, and that's good enough to be a winner. Congratulations. You've won absolutely nothing. You've won nothing. But Lisa, she just won a free download of Rockin' the Standards album, Education Rock and Roll Music, for second through sixth graders. Tim, I love that. My kids love it. We sing it. Cue the music.
Okay. All right, Scott. Yeah, go to rockinthestandards.com to check out more about the music. And Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you guys for having me.
And why don't you let our listeners know how they can follow up and learn more from you?
They can find me on Twitter at Peter M. DeWitt, or they can just go to www.petermdewitt.com, and that's my website.
Awesome. But
thank you guys for having me.
We really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your wisdom, and we would be honored to have you back, because I think we just barely scratched the ice tip of the iceberg on some of the things we want to talk about with you.
Yeah, once you get me on state testing, I'm just going to be wound up, so that's probably part.
Maybe we need like a Peter and John show, Tim. Like,
oh, there you go.
You know, the two doctors show, like bring them
Peter
together.
Peter and John. Do we get Paul in there too? Or
I love presenting with John. He's an awesome guy.
Yeah. Well, hey, that would be I think that show would pretty much blow up the internet, but
because of John, not because of me.
Yeah.
All hey, right. Tim, remind everybody quickly before they tune out and skip to the next podcast, what would we beg of them to do?
We beg of you to help us to spread the word about Global School Play Day. Put it on Facebook. Put it on Twitter. Talk about it at your staff meeting. Let people know so that we can get kids out there playing. GlobalSchoolPlayDay.com. And don't forget about EduPresenters.com. Go and sign up. Even if you're not presenting now, maybe this is your big chance to get started and, you know, get out there. And there's so many teachers that have great ideas, but they just, you know, they do a great job in their classroom, but we need them out there sharing their ideas with others, you know?
Yeah, it opens up the playing field for them to be discovered too, which is a really hard thing when you're trying to get into the presenting game. And also, we just want to thank people for listening and ask that you just give us a thumbs up or a like or follow on Facebook or whatever it is. We appreciate that, and that spreads that word and then brings amazing voices like Dr. Peter DeWitt to teachers who are bogged down, don't have the travel money, get to experience some more learning. And that's really, Tim, why we started this, is so we could learn and then share that learning with whoever else would be willing to listen.
For sure, for sure. All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody. But most of all, thanks for watching.
Mom and Dad.
Mom and Dad.
So I could be one of those Bedley brothers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bedley brothers, Bedley, Bedley brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bedley brothers, Bedley.